Welcome to the Long Thread Podcast about spinning, stitching, and weaving by hand. The podcast is presented by Long Thread Media, publishers of Spinoff, Handwoven, Piecework, and Little Looms magazines. Find us online at longthreadmedia.com. Treenway Silks is where weavers, spinners, knitters, and stitchers find the silk they love. Select from the largest variety of silk spinning fibers, silk yarn, and silk threads and ribbons at treenwaysilks.com. You'll discover a rainbow of colors thoughtfully hand-dyed in Colorado. Love natural? Treenway's array of wild silks provide choices beyond white. If you love silk, you'll love Treenway Silks, where superior quality and customer service are guaranteed. At Stewart Heritage Farm in New Market, Tennessee, farm to fiber and yarn has been part of their story for 20 years. Home to a small herd of alpacas, Stewart Heritage produces small batch roving, yarn, and finished goods in 100% alpaca and natural blends, in natural tones and brilliant hand-dyed colors. Discover the fine quality, long-lasting comfort, and soft luxury of alpaca to wear and enjoy in your home. Explore and shop alpaca at stewartheritagefarm.com. I'm your host, Long Thread Media co-founder Anne Merrow. Lily Marsh weaves home decor and wearable fabrics in her Hudson Valley, New York studio. She's deeply involved in her regional fiber community. So Lily, thanks for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
So you have a job that I think would sound like every weaver's dream, which is that you are a professional weaver. Can you tell me what that's like?
Yeah, sure. It's something that kind of came out of my life as a hobby weaver. I was originally a knitter and a hand spinner, and learning to hand spin meant I hung out with the local weavers. And of course, then, you know, on the road to perdition there, you know, the dark arts of fiber just, you know, grabbed me. So I was a pretty good weaver, and I had my own sheep for a long time. But it was when I finished a degree program and moved back here to New York State. My husband is from the New England area. And when we moved here, I found that there was a very big fiber community. And it was a much more sort of business and supply chain oriented community, in that it wasn't just the people who go to Rhinebeck, but it was all the vendors who support the people who go to Rhinebeck, right? So there was a great spinning mill near me, Battenkill Fiber Mill. There was there's a lot of indie dyers. There's a lot of farmers who have markets for finished product. It's a thriving ag tourism community around here. And so I ended up weaving for Battenkill. And, you know, one of my great role models is Elizabeth Zimmerman, and my sense of her was that she always just said yes to the next opportunity until she had to say no, until that was just something she actually couldn't do. And so now I've gone from one, when I moved here, I had one 40-inch AVL folding dobby loom that was 16 harnesses, and I am shortly to be the proud owner of three power looms, a 72-inch, a 60-inch, and a 40-inch, plus a couple of professional dobby looms. So you keep learning. Now I weave primarily with all local wool. That's what I do full time, day after day after day. And I it's work. You know how anything becomes work. But I, if I'm gone from it for very long, I find myself laying awake thinking about those black threads. What if I put them with this other thread? And, you know, it just never leaves me. Yeah, it's work, but it's work I love. Yeah.
So you still definitely think very much like every hand weaver thinks about what would happen if I tried this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That just never stops. That just never stops. Yeah. It's like any conversation I can turn towards fiber, let me tell you, you know. But it's true that goal of what if I put a little silk in here? What if I wanted to make this a scarf? Would it work as a blanket? Would it work? How does this idea, if I scale that up to 10 of them, how would that work on the loom? If I scale this down to a single piece or... Yeah, it's just the endless permutations is the word of that nexus between the fiber we have and the equipment we have and the skills we have and the skills we can push a little farther, and let's find out what that equipment can do, and maybe that fiber could do something. We could shift that in a direction. So it just becomes this like vast three-dimensional four-dimensional puzzle that's happening all the time. Yeah, it's just endlessly fascinating. I had a funny experience. So my husband and I have been married for 40 years, and I've woven for 30 years, and he's been supportive all along. But it wasn't until I started working with the power looms and getting a lot of customers that he started realizing, this is really complex what you do, Lily. This is really much more involved than I ever realized it was. And you just get there one step at a time. Yeah.
I think that that's an experience that a lot of weavers have, that, you know, that there's not necessarily a lot of understanding from the outside that this is not only something that you love, but something that really engages like every part of your brain and every part of your creativity. Yes. And that it's been a really important technology.
Yes. Yes. And I like what you say about it encompasses, in a sense, it's like food, only you don't taste it, but you can smell it. You can smell the wool. You can smell the clean wool, smell the loom. You hear the sounds that the bobbins make when I do sectional beaming. And I always love sectional beaming because when the bobbins are full, there's this little low, little grumble, grumble, grumble. And as the bobbins empty it towards the end of the warp, it gets a higher pitch and a higher pitch. And then it's just like little birds chirping along. And so it is, it's this physical sensation, even when using power looms, that is as much a mental and intellectual challenge and then an artistic challenge. Is this brown going to look nice to that gray? Is that going to work? Is this going to, how's the proportions work? Yeah. So it really does encompass everything. It's an endlessly fascinating thing that I do.
So you mentioned blankets and scarves. What do you weave?
Well, I'm considered a custom weaver. So the original market here for me that I primarily started weaving for is 52 by 72 inch blankets. There's a lot of farmers here with access to really well attended farmers markets. And so they often want something that will have wide appeal. Home decor is easier sometimes to sell than something that's wearable and needs to go with hair color and skin tone and that sort of thing. And so I do a lot of blankets. I've lately been doing a lot of what we call lap robes, which are 40 by 60 inches. So that's a nice couch throw size. I do some table runners. There are some old customers of mine who have smaller flocks, and they like me to do some table runners and some stoles, some wider scarves, some shawls. It's funny, as I've worked, I have realized how many different terms we have for something you wrap around your neck that's about 20 inches wide and 72 inches long, right? That's a stole or a scarf or a shawl or whatever. So I do a lot of those. I've lately started doing a lot of what I call cut and sew scarves, which means I weave a large panel, might be 52 by 72, and I cut scarves out of that, right? So that now all four edges are cut and sewn to some extent, because it was just taking way too long when I started to get orders for 25 scarves to weave a narrow scarf one after another. That takes a long time, even on a power loom. So I've been experimenting with that, and that's been really well received. I've started doing, just in the last 2 years, a lot more sewing yardage, which I'm really fascinated by. So I have a couple of designers now that I work with who are interested in having sort of jacket, blazer material. I have a customer in Chicago who's interested in doing winter coats, very classic women's winter coats in 100% wool. And so that's going to be a lot of fun to experiment and play with them. But yeah, so I do home decor to small wearables to sewing yardage. And I got somebody an email today just from someone asking about upholstery fabric. So that'll be a whole nother thing to play with. And, you know, yeah, it'll be an interesting time.
I think a lot of weavers don't like to sew. How do you feel about that? Do you do your own sewing?
So that is my worst fiber skill. Sewing. I am a really terrible sewer. Part of it is because when I was a very small child, I lost the tip of my right thumb. I'm right-handed, and I lost the tip of my thumb in a mowing machine. And so I have a really hard time picking up a needle that lays on the table. I can't pick up pins. I can't pick up. But I have learned to work with people who do sew, and I like seeing what they make. I, you know, it's a way for me to participate. That was actually one of the big changes when I came to New York and started working with this fiber community, is realizing that I don't have to do everything. I can be part of an artistic team in a way that I think I began to explore. And I'm sorry, I keep talking about my graduate school work, but I saw how much that's what Elizabeth Zimmerman did. She saw herself as part of a community in a way that if you define yourself as the artist, you're sort of the hero, right? You're the heroine on the journey if you're the artist. But if you're just the person who provides the cloth or makes the blanket and sees your job as showing off this fabulous wool, then you get to take a little bit more of a back seat and let other people's skills shine. And I found that incredibly freeing.
And now a word from our sponsors. Brown Sheep Company is a four-generation family business bringing you high-quality wool and natural fiber yarns. We spin and dye U.S.-grown wool into hundreds of vibrant colors at our mill in western Nebraska. Our mill has something to offer for every craft, from our well-known knitting and crocheting yarn to wool roving for spinning and felting. We offer U.S.-made needlepoint yarn, as well as yarn on cones for weaving projects. Learn more about our company and products at brownsheep.com. KnitPicks.com has been serving the knitting community for over 20 years and believes knitting is for everyone, which is why they work hard to make knitting accessible, affordable, and approachable. KnitPicks responsibly sources its fiber to create an extensive selection of affordable yarns like High Desert from Shanico Wool Company. Are you looking for an ethical, eco-friendly yarn to try? Look no further than KnitPicks Eco Yarn Line. Need needles? KnitPicks makes a selection for knitters right at their Vancouver, Washington headquarters. KnitPicks.com, a place for every knitter. And now back to the show. That's a really interesting idea. I think one of the questions that comes up, particularly around weavers, is, you know, there's always that old debate. Is it an art? Is it a craft? Is it an artisan thing? And one of my colleagues said, spinners may think of themselves as crafters, but weavers think of themselves as fiber artists. So I think it's interesting that you found something sort of freeing in seeing yourself as somebody who's part of something as opposed to that.
Yeah. I sometimes think of that as a little bit of a problem with weavers, because I see in my experience between like knitters and weavers, you know, knitters are wildly inventive, just wildly inventive. The most ordinary knitters will make, you know, everything from, you know, the political, what were they, the pink hats that we all wore to Washington D.C. on the Women's March, the pussy hats, the pink pussy hats, you know, to just the sense of imagination and adventure is very high in my estimation among knitters. Weavers, it seems to me, and I don't want to step on any toes here, but weavers seem to me suffer from taking themselves awfully serious as artists. And so there's a little bit more hesitation in that, just throw yourself into it. Of course, there's other reasons as well. I mean, when you've bought a little knitting yarn and a couple pairs of needles, you don't have a huge investment in that project, right? You can frog it out and it's done. You know, you can do something else. To throw something on your loom, once you've got that warp measured, that's not really going to be very many other things. You know, it's a lot bigger upfront investment. The tools just themselves are way more expensive. But I do think that because weaving does have this history as an art form, then there's almost a reputation we need to uphold. Mm-hmm. And there's less, I just see less experimentation among weavers. Yeah. And I think that idea, one of the other things, so here's a painfully academic analysis. The way I think that weavers often think of themselves is as a practitioner of a craft that focuses on the skills and on the tools. And so we are very free to look at other cultures. How do the Japanese weave? How do the Scottish weave? How do the Peruvians weave? How do the Indians of the subcontinent weave? How do the Navajos? So we look across time. We look, how did they weave at various points of time? So, but it's always about weaving. And I have found that can feel to me like a kind of a horizontal way to look at our craft. And I find myself fascinating by what feels to me like a vertical way to look at, which is follow my materials, so that now I'm not just talking to other weavers. I'm talking to sheep farmers and shearers and sheep breeders and people who are interested in how sheep farming affects land, and how then the processors, are they using a woolen or a worsted methodology? What are they scouring with? What are the processes they're using for dyeing? So that it goes all the way up. What is it that my customers want me to make for them, so that there is a finished product that will reach their market? So who is their market? Who is going to be the end user? What do they want in a project, right? So that suddenly the people that I'm interacting with every day is a very different kind of group of people. And it's a much more sort of immediately accessible community to me. So I love the days that I go out and I help my farmers with their shearing, and I run their skirting table. Then we haul it to the mill, so that it becomes then very much this team effort from beginning to end that I get to be part of. And that I just find that so much more satisfying than trying to do everything myself and trying to do it at a level which says I'm an artist, that I have to do everything beautifully.
So tell me a little bit about how the materials that you work with, and, coming from your local sort of Hudson Valley region, how that affects your weaving and your cloth.
Well, wool, we tend to think of something as 100% wool and that defines it. When, of course, we all know, Deb Robson's books and Clara Park's books on breed-specific weaving is that all wool is not the same, right? There's everything from Cotswold and Lincoln long wool and the classic English breeds, which are very long, very strong, often a kind of coarse, could be quite scratchy wool, right? All the way through the south, those are the long wools. And then there are the down wools, right, which are often called medium breeds. So those are often meat sheep, or they're Dorsets, or Corriedale is sometimes considered a medium breed, and all the way to the fine wool. So that when I have a customer who loves her sheep, so she raises a certain kind of sheep. And so I just finished up a bunch of ponchos for Southern Vermont Farm. Laura Birch is her name. She's a wonderful customer of mine. And she raises Leicester long wools. And they're a lovely, strong, a little bit coarse, not super soft. So it really requires all my skill as a weaver to take advantage of their strength and at the same time emphasize what softness there is. She had me make ponchos that she was going to sew. So they were sort of poncho blanks that she's now going to sew together. And how do you get the best drape? How do you get the right softness? Because it's not going to be worn next to the skin, but you're going to be touching it. How do you get a smoothness to the surface? But that's all the stuff when I get a wool, and there's a lot of long wool in New York State that because the different breeds do better in different climates, right? A lot of sheep are desert animals. We're not a desert up here. The Merinas and Rambouillets with those heavy, beautiful, fine fleeces, they don't do well in our damper climates up here. So we have a lot of the medium and the long wools. So what I get to weave, although I have one customer, I get to weave very fine Western wool from one customer in Montana. She raises Targhee, and they're just stunningly soft. What I get to weave, though, is working on how do I take the characteristic of the wool I have, often long wools or medium breeds, and bring out its best. I have to admit, one of the breeds that I especially like working with is East Frisian. It's a dairy sheep that often their wool just gets thrown away. But it's a lovely medium wool that I find a wonderful affinity. It makes beautiful blankets and couch throws and dyes beautifully. And, I just love working with that wool. We got a lot of sheep dairies here in the Northeast.
I think a lot of weavers turn first to cotton and then maybe Tencel and silk. It's interesting that you have a lot of pull toward wool. Do you think that's because you started with sheep, or do you think that that's because of what you want to weave? Where does that come from?
I think that it's an element of all of those things. I used to laugh that I wanted to knit things for my new babies, but I couldn't find any wool yarns back in the early 80s in my local yarn shops in Indiana. And so I talked my husband into buying sheep. And we ended up with like 50 Corriedales, and I was selling hand spinning fleeces. But ever since I was a child, I've loved farm life. My dad, who was an international airline pilot, grew up on a horse run dairy farm. I mean, he, as a very small boy, rode on the milk wagon while they delivered milk by horse in town from their cows. And so he left the farm as fast as he could. And I feel like much of my life has been trying to get back to the farm as much as I could. And, you know, I'm 64 now. I tell my husband, if we were young again, I'd have sheep in a red hot minute. You know, I think he's quite grateful that we don't, but you know, it's bad enough moving looms and, you know, but yeah, I love animals. I love sheep. I love being outside, taking care of them. This is as close as I get to be to them now. Yeah.
But you are involved in sort of a network there, the Hudson Valley Textile Project, which is everything from the farmer to the scouring mill, to the scouring facility, to the mill, to the end user, et cetera. So you are,
yeah,
you are closer to the sheep than a lot of folks are.
Yes, I take a lot of pleasure in that. So the Hudson Valley Textile Project is, as you say, it's a group of us who got together. I'm one of the founding board members. The two founders were Gail Perinello, who owned a yarn shop in Cornwall, and Mary Jean Packer, who owns Bat and Kill Fiber Mill. And they had an idea of what could we do to strengthen the supply chain for fiber all the way to the finished product, so that we're not just making stuff for other artisans, like not just making yarn for artisans to do something with, but we're actually making finished things that somebody who's not a fiber person might look at that blanket or that scarf and say, yeah, I want to buy that. And so that's been an incredible network of people to just be part of that community with them. That, you know, like I said, there are farmers that I get sent out sometimes because I had sheep. I get sent out sometimes by the project and I talk to them about how can they keep their pastures cleaner, or how do you skirt at shearing? How do you store a fleece? How do you get it to the mill? What kinds of things a certain kind of breed might be good for on a loom, or whether it's a knitting. You know, we have some small machine knitters around here, small batch machine knitters around here in the Hudson Valley. So it's been such an exciting time. And we've been doing very well. We started in 2019, I think, 2017, 2018, somewhere in there. Anything before the pandemic these days just seems like light years ago now. But when we started, it was just a group of us, and we were asking each other, what is the thing we need most? And we discovered that everybody thought we needed local scouring, because the ability to wash the wool is always the first step into anything next that has to happen to it. And so we were able to, you know, raise money, get some grants. We bought a scouring line out of New Zealand. We found a place for it. It's up and running. It's called Clean Fleece New York. And now you don't need to have 1,000 pounds and ship it off to chargers. Our minimum is 50 pounds. So somebody with a dozen sheep has enough wool that they can get it processed and then ship it to where they want it, to what they want done with it after that. And that's made a huge difference. We're in the current process now. We've become part of the New York State's Fashion Innovation Center, a new organization that just started this year. And it's still getting up and running, but we are looking towards opening possibly a wool warehouse that will enable us to buy wool from farmers and have it on hand, so that when someone else comes to us and says, oh, I want to make something out of Wensleydale, we can say, we have 100 pounds of Wensleydale on the shelves. What would you like? Instead of saying, oh, I know somebody who has Wensleydales, but they just got sheared and I think they have a project. And so we have to wait for another year to get in line for that wool. But a wool warehouse would put us on a footing where we can really start to have a more steady supply of interesting, unique wools that we can offer a user who wants to create an end product. I know that sounds very businesslike and doesn't sound all that all that artistic or creative, but I find that sort of thing endlessly fascinating, just endlessly fascinating.
Well, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned that you were sort of following the model of just, you know, say yes to the next thing. But, you know, what does it look like to go from, I love to weave, maybe I'm going to put something in a guild sale, somebody asked me to weave a blanket. What is the progression from that to my business is being a custom weaver? I've outgrown my house. You know, what is the progression there?
Well, I think the progression is probably different for all sorts of people. One of them is having a friend like Mary Jean Packer, who my daughters call her. They say, she's your you can do it friend. So, you know, somebody who will just say, I think that sounds cool. Yes, do it. But it is a matter of, you know, I don't have any formal training in weaving other than having a lot of guild friends and people who showed me what to do, and then reading a lot of books and taking a few workshops and week-long classes, and then just like figuring it out. Like, how do you finish? How do you finish 25 blankets? You do them 3 at a time in your washing machine, and you get a clothesline and you hang them up. And then you buy a steam iron that's got a nice reservoir of about 1.5 gallons, and you press them. And but then you need a big table. You know, you need a table and you need some sort of pressing surface. So you figure that out. When we moved here, I had none of that stuff. And then I figured out we had this length, my pressing table is a table that my husband made out of those metal storage units that you buy at Lowe's. So they're rated for 800 pounds, so I can put a full beam on them. And then the pressing surface was a length of countertop that was left here at the house when the previous owner moved. And I realized, well, that's nicely as wide as the table. So I had my husband cut that square on his saw. And then I covered that with the heaviest piece of wool that I could find, a commercial fabric, and sewed that tight on there. And that's what I press. And I just pull blankets over it and press as I go. It's been really interesting doing yardage because I have discovered that the limits of yardage that I can do, say it's about a 50-inch wide fabric, that the limits is about 30 yards. More than that, I can't do it in my washing machine. But it took a lot of, you know, a little trial and error. I have a couple of pieces that are very badly, unevenly fold. I still keep them around because I keep thinking I'm going to cut out some parts and do something with them. But it's just experimenting. It's just trial and error. And then not being afraid to do the next step. So like I have had studio assistants for off and on for years. And now I actually have 2 studio assistants who work for me about 21 hours a week. And, you know, I had 2 studios for a while, and the realization that that's just not working for me anymore. I need more looms to keep these guys busy. And I need a bigger space. So then you go to the landlord and you say, do you have any space that I could put a compressor into? Because that's what my power looms require. And he said, I just bought a building and I'll bet we could put you in there. And so that's, again, a place where you like, I asked the question and he said, yes. Am I going to say no? Or could I do this? So you find out. I had a really wonderful experience this last week. As I've been saying to my girls, you know, what I'm doing is very, very exciting, but exciting is really close in the heart to terrifying, right? Those are really close emotions. And so I been doing this big move. It's a lot of expense. I'm buying new equipment to bring in. It's just way bigger than I ever imagined it would be. And so I was kind of complaining to another weaver, a very skilled, her name is Rabbit Goody. She has Thistle Hill Weavers here in New York. She does very high-end historical reproductions, among other things. And I was kind of crying a little bit on her shoulder about, oh my God, I'm just terrified. And she patted my arm and she said, oh, what else would you do with your time? And it was so, well, yeah, what else would I do? This is what I want to do. If you ask me, what do I want to do tomorrow? I want to show up in my studio and see what else we can make.
Wow.
That's what I want to do. Yeah. So it's been incredibly freeing.
You mentioned a big move. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So in the past, when I moved here to New York State, we've I must have had some inkling that this was all going to balloon because I made sure that we bought a house that allowed me to operate a business out of it because there's different zoning stuff in New York State than there was in Indiana. And I was, you know, I had just finished my PhD and I had learned to take myself more seriously in a sense. So we bought a house, we took out a wall, I put my looms in there. And pretty quickly that 40-inch folding dobby was not big enough and I bought a 60-inch loom. So those were happily weaving in the basement. And then I realized I wanted to do some dyeing, but our house is on a septic system and a federally protected wetland. And the last thing you want to do is wake up some morning and realize that your blue dyes just turned the wetland blue. That's not a good look. So there's old industrial buildings around here that people have turned into artist studios. One of those is a complex called the Shirt Factory. And so I rented a little studio because it's got access to the city sewers and is in fact connected to the industrial sewers, right? Because it used to be a factory. So I could die there. It was a very small studio. I loved demonstrating there. I loved having a little place where I could meet customers that wasn't my house. Sometimes you don't want to bring people into the house. But my main production studio was always here at the house. And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And I realized I can't, you know, I need to be able to use, I got my power loom, which meant then that my 60-inch and my 72-inch looms were here at the house, and I had to move the other loom to the Shirt Factory, which suddenly now I've got a loom there that if I want to use it, I have to run to it. And it just became more and more inconvenient. And my husband was pointing out, and I have to agree, that we were quickly just living above the shop because – and that was not quite how he saw the house that he wanted. So – you know, I mean, I was pretty much taking over the entire basement. We had knocked out a few walls. It's a lovely studio space. My brother worried about me a little bit. He said, I fear you're becoming a little hobbit in a hole down there. and so there is an element of truth to that. So when I finally asked my landlord, Eric Uncalf, at the Shirt Factory, he said, yeah, I just bought a building and I could give you 1,500 square feet. So that's what we're doing. And of course, so then as soon as you say yes to the universe, there's a weaver that I had been talking to out in Montana, a lovely man who was rebuilding a loom very similar to the kind of power loom that I run, which is an AVL industrial Dobby loom. And he was rebuilding it and he was having some trouble. So he'd call me up periodically and we'd talk about the looms. And he'd talk to my husband. My husband's a computer engineer, so that helped a lot. But he ended up being diagnosed with a very significant heart issue, and he called me up 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and asked if I wanted to buy all his equipment, which means another power loom, a couple more professional Dobby looms, which are just wonderful production looms, and a large rug loom, as well as all sorts of ancillary materials. So having now this new big space, I'm now going to be as crowded in it as I was in my basement because I have lots of new toys to play with. And, you know, and one of the things, so not only is a production loom, you know, running, making things for people, I often am approached about teaching. And what I would really like to do is run an apprentice program for production weavers, for people who want to begin to understand what it would take to be a production weaver, how they might find a market for that sort of thing, how they have to work with various other groups, and just really, you know, show people that one of the goals, this goes back to the Hudson Valley Textile Project, one of the ideas that we've been throwing around is how Harris Tweeds is a bunch of weavers who have their stuff centrally finished to a standard. And that's a logo, a product, a quality that is recognized around the world. And that there's nothing that says we couldn't do that too. Mm-hmm. That here in the Hudson Valley, where we have some really good wool, and there's a lot of people who weave, that we couldn't start to move in that direction of production weavers who are producing Hudson Valley farm cloth. So that's one of the goals we're starting to think about.
So I'm a rigid heddle and ankle weaver. Can you tell me what a professional Dobby and a power loom, what that means?
So on a rigid heddle loom, a rigid heddle to me is much more like a backstrap loom. And you can do some very fine things with a backstrap loom and with a rigid heddle. You have absolute flexibility, in fact, of what you want to make, which threads you're picking up. You can pick up a whole set of threads. You can use a couple of different rigid heddles and pick up different threads. So that's all incredibly flexible. So the more complex you get with a floor loom or a power loom, you lose some of that flexibility. So a Dobby loom, so a lot of people know what a floor loom is. A floor loom, which maybe say has 8 shafts, which are the harnesses. So a rigid heddle has 1, but on a floor loom, you would have at least 4, 8, 16, 24. And you have that number of treadles plus 2 that you're weaving the pattern in. So you're using your feet to lift up the harnesses where on a rigid heddle you're lifting up, or on a backstrap loom you're lifting up just one set of threads. On a floor loom you can do a lot, but you're using a pattern that you're tramping out with your feet. On a dobby loom, which is what all I have now, on a dobby loom, what you have is a kind of music box arrangement on the side of the loom. It can be wooden tiles with screw-in pegs that are connected to in a series that roll up through the loom and tap little wooden fingers, which says, okay, on this tile, you're going to pick up harness 1, harness 3, harness 7, harness 12, right? And then the next tile rolls up. It's going to be a whole different set that get lifted up to make the pattern. And that's what a dobby does. A computer dobby does that on a computer because those pegs are actually the original binary code of a computer. They are either the yes or the no of the 1 and the 0 in the original computing software. So now a power loom has that. It has that computer dobby running. But it also uses compressed air to throw the shuttle.
Is it still hand weaving?
You could get an argument there. You could get an argument, and I'm sure you would. So for me, the power loom that is throwing the shuttle and is lifting the harnesses, right? So it's running. I have to change the bobbins when they empty. I have to fix any broken threads. I have to tend to the edges, make sure that everything's running well. And it's not like a power loom like you see in a global industry. If you were to, you know, look at cotton weaving in Malaysia, the power looms that are running there, it's not like that because you can watch it run, but you can't leave it, you know, because at any chance something might or will happen that you need to stop the machine, straighten something out, run it again. So, and because I'm doing sectional beaming, there is not a thread on that loom that I have not physically touched in every inch of it, right? So to me, it is at the very edge of hand weaving, but it still feels like hand weaving to me. And it allows me to pay attention to the materials. Like, is this wool going to have issues with static? Is this wool something I got to be careful about humidity in the room about? Is this wool a single or applied wool? Is this wool a worsted or a woolen? So it forces me to pay attention to the materials in a very specific way that really does require me to use all my weaverly skills. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure you get some people who say, nope, not a hand loom. And in a way it isn't, but it's not a hand loom. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I didn't mean for that to be a gotcha question. I know somebody who got kicked out of her guild because she wasn't a real weaver because she was weaving plain weave. So there's a whole, well, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't mean for that to be a gotcha question.
No, I know. And it's not really a gotcha question. It's a legit question. And it forces me to think about how far do I want to go, right? Do I want to turn my looms over to my assistants and sit there and design? No, I don't really want to do that. Do I want to, you know, merely be the spokesperson for the studio and other people do all the weaving? No, I don't really want to do that. Mm-hmm. It's a legit question. I make cloth that I'm really proud of. And I think that means I'm a weaver, whether I'm a hand weaver or something else, that's up to you to decide. I have to, for my new studio, which we're just moving into this week, I have to decide on my signage. I have a glass door, for heaven's sakes, on my studio that I'm going to have a sign on. So I've been trying to think about, am I just going to say Lily Marsh Studios, LLC, Custom Weaving?
Nice.
I think that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah. You know, I think there are very old weaving technologies that are also not physically throwing the shuttle and physically lifting the treadles at a time. Yeah, fly shuttles and jacquard looms. So, you know, there's always sort of a...
Yeah. Yeah, my dobby looms, even the mechanical dobbies, you know, that's early industrial. Those are the looms that the Luddites were burning because they put weavers out of work. Right. They took a skilled activity and made it a differently skilled activity. Mm-hmm. And so it's old technology. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the things I like in working with the wool, in that because it's all so variable from week to week, whatever I have that a customer has asked me to weave, it keeps me on my toes to pay attention to that variability. And I have to, again, it's like the big moving puzzle pieces that I have to work with. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah. So you mentioned that a lot of what you learned came from having guild friends. Are you still involved in guilds? Do you still find yourself moving among circles of more traditional hand weavers?
Less so now, mostly because I have a great local guild, Hudson Mohawk Guild. And when I was less busy doing so much work, I was able to participate in the shows and sales, and I went to the meetings. I was on a couple committees. I think I'm still on the scholarship committee when someone applies for a grant from the guild. But it is true that the direction that most guild members want to take is a very sort of singular artistic. So they see making 25 blankets all the same as just not something they want to do. And that's fine. They don't have to do that. But they don't really understand why I want to do that, why I find that fascinating. You know, often you hear guild members saying, oh, I never do anything on commission. And I never do anything that's one of a kind on commission. If you want something from me, you have to order six of them. You know, so it's like wholesale in that sense. But I work almost all on commission. So it's just that I think we have different aims, different goals. And it can be sometimes a little hard for someone to understand why, you know, like I used to work with Tencel a lot before I moved to New York State. And Tencel dies like a dream. It weaves like a dream. It's, you know, it's a beautiful color that you can get on it. I just don't particularly like the cloth it makes anymore, right? And I find I really like wool cloth. I really like its sustainability. I really like the way it feels in the hand, the way it drapes on the body. I like the fact that it's going to last forever, you know, as long as you take care of it. And so, you know, wool weavers don't necessarily understand Tencel weavers. I just think it's a matter of personal taste and you know, we kind of can live in our own little silos a little bit about this is what I like, going to the farms and talking and trumping through the fields. And I'm not sure that a lot of those other women would like that part of it. Yeah.
You're using CompuDobby and computer controlled looms and a lot of shafts. Are you making very complex cloth?
Surprisingly not often. I sometimes do, but more and more it's true that I'm doing like a herringbone or a Dornick twill, or I do like for some of the blankets and some of the scarves, I love the Irene Wood 16 harness patterns. I do a lot of 16 harness twills. I'm liking more and more the idea of the amalgamated patterns. I use a lot of handweaving.net because it's easy to download. I mean, I have all the old books, but it's easy to download when it's already in a computer program. And there's a way to amalgamate patterns there, which can give an incredibly cool complexity to a simple twill. But at the same time, a lot of my farmers and customers, they want something they can recognize. They don't, you know, they often think they just want a plaid. They just want a simple twill. They want a herringbone with stripes. They want a, right? So I'm hopeful that with my new space, one of the things I have often done is, so primarily I'm a wholesale weaver in that sense. I do custom weaving, but I have often used a small retail line as a place where I try out ideas or experiments, or where I am able to sort of see, well, here's something that worked as a scarf. What if I just wanted to make 10 of them? What can I do that? Does it scale up? How does that work? Which loom would I put that on? And so I'm hopeful that now with this new larger space and a little more efficient running, I'll be able to do more of that sort of thing, have more of a retail line that shows what we can do, and then have that turn over into a wholesale piece at scale.
So you started off as a hobby or personal interest weaver. Do you do any of that yourself now? I find I've become really good at turning my hobby into my job. So I was I loved books, so I became a book editor, and then I learned to knit, so I became a knitting book editor. And then, so do you find that the same thing has happened to you?
A little bit, but I still knit a lot. So I think that knitting is more my hobby, whereas weaving is much more the professional intellectual pursuit. And my interaction with community is through weaving. And there's a group of women that I knit with, but they're always And in a sense, that's where I am, in a sense, most creative in a way, because I almost never use a pattern when I'm knitting. I just am sort of making it up as I go. They're very, the friends that I knit with are always very knowledgeable, and they can name the sweater and the designer. And it's like, well, this is a, you know, this is just something I made up, and I never know any of those designers.
This is a Lily Marsh original.
This is, yeah. But, and I like my sleeves 3/4. I hate long sleeves. So, you know, everything is very custom that I make for myself. But yeah, the only thing that I find I would like to play with more is I've started doing indigo dyeing, but I've also found a way to integrate that into my customer. I have a customer who's shearing now, and, you know, I'll be getting his wool at the end of July, and he wants 18 pounds of it indigo dyed. So I did 15 for him last year, so I know I can do that much, and it'll be fun to do it again. That and working with a little silk. I love the wool silk combination. Wool in the warp and silk in the weft is a gorgeous, gorgeous combination. And so I splurged on another weaver's stash reduction sale and bought about 30 pounds of a blanket wake silk that I'm hopeful to put into some. Yeah, but that'll be part of, again, that retail line. That's just the place where I get to experiment and play with.
All of the materials that you're talking about, you know, you've talked about making, you know, 30 yards of fabric or so many blankets, but all of the materials that you're talking about are highly variable. So, you know, wool might not be exactly the same from one year to the next. The yarn might be different. And what made me think of that is indigo dyeing, because, you know, you have to refine it, and it's not something that is just mindlessly repeatable. So you're always having to adjust a little bit to the materials you're using.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what keeps 25 blankets from being boring, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, and you know how weaving is so front end heavy in the sense that you make this design, you dye the colors you want. You've picked out the yarn, you dye the colors, you make the warp, then you do the weft, and then you finish. And it's not until it's wet finished and steamed that you think, did it turn out? Right? So it is, you know, it's like I tell, you know, when I was a child, we used to play with dominoes, where you would line all the dominoes up, you know, standing on end, and make all these curves and circles and designs. And then you press the first one to see if they would all fall down, right? And that's a little bit what the weaving feels like for me, because each project has some new variable in it that is just like, you don't know. You're making choices all along the way, choices that can't be reversed. Were they mostly the right choices? And that's
true.
You know, that's both the creative and the, because sometimes, well, that choice wasn't so good. So is there something I can do to fix that? You know, is there, what can I do to remedy that or sort of ameliorate that or put it in a little better position or, you know, what can be done? And so that's, mm-hmm. so the creative becomes for me the whole process, not just see the pretty thing I made. It's the whole process becomes, I guess that's what it is. And I hadn't really thought about it before, but that the whole process becomes the act of creation, not just the thing itself. I'm not sure that really makes sense, but somehow there's something there that feels right.
There's almost an element of, well, never mind. I'm not going to say that was dumb. I was going to say there's something about it that's almost like performance art in a way, that where the process becomes part as much a part of it as the product.
Oh, I think that's, you know, right. I think that's not dumb. I think weaving as performance art rather than, oh my gosh, have you started a train of thought in my head? Because I used to do quite a lot of singing in public. And I always laughed about, you know, when you're singing, you have, no matter how many times you did it right in practice, you have to do it right tonight. You have to do it the one time you have an audience. And that weaving is a lot less. You can throw away a lot of weaving and just show the one that worked out really well, right?
That's true.
But what I'm doing really is a kind of combining of the two. Mm-hmm. In that I've got a customer's yarn, can't throw that out, not without some serious apologies, right? And it might be several thousand dollars worth of yarn, so you got to figure out how to use it. And the performance art I like that a lot. The performance art is in creating the finished product. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very good. I like that a lot.
So a lot of what we talked about is the experience of being a custom weaver, but part of what you're doing is being just a full-time weaver. So as somebody who spends your time on it, who uses your body for it all the time, do you have advice for people who are passionate weavers along a sort of a different path?
Meaning they just want to do more weaving, or what do you mean along a different path?
You know, somebody who enjoys being part of a guild and experimenting, you know, making scarves here and there. Somebody who is more, I think the word hobby often gets a bad rap, but an amateur weaver.
Yeah. And don't forget, amateur means you love it. Amateurs amateurs should not be seen as hobby. It's you love it, and so you do it. I would say my advice for somebody like that, there's an anecdote that really made me think about aging differently. And that is that when eyeglasses were invented, they really only came into common use, you know, around the year 1000, 1200, pretty early, but it took a long time. They were invented around 800, but it took a long time for ordinary people to get access to them. And it was at the sort of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, in the sense that, and they talked about what an incredible leap forward it was when an artisan who had maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years of experience in doing what they did, whether it was watchmaking or weaving or any kind of making that they were pursuing, suddenly had 20 more years to get better because they could see. They didn't have to stop what they were doing, right? So as an older weaver myself, the thing that I'm very careful of is taking care of my body and my flexibility and my hands, because I don't want carpal tunnel syndrome or sore joints or the fact that I have a harder time getting up and down to get under the loom for tie-ups or to fix something or to lift beams. I don't want that to be the thing that says I stop weaving, right? So I think you have to understand that as a weaver, your body is part of the process. I mean, I've worked out with a trainer for decades now and work out with weights twice a week and pay a lot of attention to mobility and flexibility. And I have a whole series of hand exercises, because once you have that carpal tunnel system, you never quite get the skills back. You never quite get the strength in your hands. And that's just, I don't want that to be the reason I say, I'm not going to the studio today. I'm thinking about downsizing. I'm thinking about doing something different. I'm still interested in these things, but I don't find I can do it. And I find that, you know, you just have to take care of yourself as a point in the production. I'm not sure that's quite what you really meant, but I must admit.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
They talk so much about the incredible benefit to women of resistance training. And I want to say, amen, preach it. Yeah. It's incredible.
So what do you have coming up? What's exciting for you aside from this big move of to your new studio?
Yeah, the big move. And then I'm at Maryland Sheep and Wool, which is one of my very favorite festivals. I love Maryland. Is very different from Rhinebeck. Maryland feels like it has a deeper agricultural roots. And it's a fascinating festival to go to. And that's the first weekend in May. And then on the 14th of May, I fly out to Montana to pack up this studio that I'm buying and, you know, send it on a truck back. And then the big thing for me this summer is June 5th, I have surgery. So I'm going to knee replacement. But that'll be the second knee replacement I've had. So by mid-July, I should be back at the looms working, getting that studio in order and dyeing that 18 pounds of indigo. So,
oh my gosh. Are you going to have a party to celebrate?
I am. I'm trying to figure out at what point, you know, you never really finished moving. There's always stuff that goes back and forth or rearranging what you do, but I'm going to have to pick a date and just have an open house. One of the things, of course, is having had my studio in my house all these years, I have such a stash of craft stuff that I don't really do anymore. So I'm thinking about doing both an open house and a random craft giveaway of stuff that I just have. Like, I used to do bookmaking, so I've got some interesting paper, and I used to do a lot more spinning than I do now. So I've got some spinning yarns. I've got silk fibers for spinning. So I have a bunch of stuff, and I'm just thinking about putting some boxes out and saying, it's a party favor. Take what you want. If you want that 2 pounds of silk, take it to get it off my conscience.
Isn't that the way that a hobbit's birthday party went? You'd go, the hobbit would throw a birthday party and they'd give you something?
Yes, I have become, I have become that hobbit. Yes. Yeah, that's true. I'll have to tell my brother, who's absolutely right. Of course, you know how any spring cleaning, after you bite the bullet, it feels awfully good to let go of old expectations and old ideas and to just go with the ones that seem most fruitful. I find that to be like the key element of aging, is sort of paring down to what's the thing that I really want to do more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And grasping that with both hands. Because what else would you do with your time, right?
Just keep weaving.
Yeah.
Well, Lily, thank you so much for your time. And I can't wait to see what your new space looks like and to catch up with you next.
Yes, it'll be a lot of fun. And I do plan on having like pretty regular hours for tours and that sort of thing. So
come by. Great.
Yeah.
Thanks
a
lot.
Come by. Thank you.
Thanks to our sponsors for supporting the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Long Thread Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate the show and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again.